Good morning. The open meeting of the Federal Election Commission for Thursday, April 11th, 2019 will come to order. Sorry for the slight delay. We have a very interesting agenda. Agenda note, the item 3 on the agenda, draft advisory opinion 2018-13. We're going to not discuss that today. The commission had put out a new draft response to that AO, I think, yesterday. And the requester wanted an opportunity to review that and perhaps provide comments on it, which is perfectly reasonable. So we expect to take that up at the next meeting. The first item on the agenda is Draft Advisory Opinion 2018-12, Defending Digital Campaigns, Inc., by some old friends of the commission, Mark Elias and Michael Toner, former commissioner. Welcome back. Actually, I shouldn't say welcome back because you've probably never been to this building. I know, whole new fancy conference room. I bet you're almost sorry you left. Almost. We have a large group of people who have come to engage with us on this, and I invite you to come to the table, and I'm sure we're going to have some questions for you. Yes, actually, we should do the minutes first. While you're getting settled, we'll do the minutes. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move approval of the minutes for the meeting on March 28th, 2019. Assuming that's 19, it says 18 on there, but I'm going to assume that it's 19. And that's set forth in agenda document number 19-12-A.
Vice Chairman has moved approval of the minutes as set forth in agenda document 19-12-A. Any discussion on the motion? If not, I will call the question. All in favor say aye.
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 And the motion passes unanimously. Yeah, we have another preliminary motion, so Mr. Vice Chairman.
All right, thank you, Madam Chair. I move to suspend the rules on the timely submission of agenda documents in order that the Commission may consider the late submission of agenda document number 19-14-B.
We have a motion from the Vice Chairman to suspend the rules on the timely submission of agenda documents to consider 19-14-B. Any discussion on the motion? If not, I'll call the question. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion passes unanimously. Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. And that brings us to the very interesting draft advisory opinion, 2018-12. Mr. Wensiker.
Thank you, Chair Weintraub. Good morning, commissioners. Agenda documents 1843A and 1843B are draft responses to an advisory opinion request submitted by Defending Digital Campaigns, Inc. The requester asks whether it may provide or facilitate the provision of certain cybersecurity services, software, and hardware to federal candidate committees and national party committees on a nonpartisan basis and according to predetermined objective criteria. Draft A concludes that the proposal is permissible because the provision of the services described in the request would not be made for the purpose of influencing a federal election or in connection with the federal election, and thus would not constitute a prohibited in-kind contribution. Draft B concludes that the proposal is impermissible because the provision of the services described in the request would be in connection with the federal election and thus would constitute a prohibited in-kind contribution. We received no comments on the request. Campaign Legal Center submitted a comment on the Draft A last October and an updated comment on Draft A last week. The requester submitted a comment and supplementary information on the drafts. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Wensinger. And in one of the in the second comment from CLC, there was a proposal for an alternative analysis. So there's draft A, draft B, and not quite draft C, but something that potentially could become draft C. I'd like to start by asking the requesters if they'd like to speak to the proposal.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And good morning. Pleasure to be here. Michael Toner and Mark Elias on behalf of Defending Digital Campaigns, Inc. Love your new space. and this meeting room. It's just lovely. And we really want to thank the commission's patience and indulgence concerning this matter. It's been like Groundhog Day. Every 2 weeks we were on the agenda and then carried over. But we really appreciate the commission accommodating this matter for many months, because obviously there's a number of novel issues here, complex issues. But it's a pleasure to introduce Matt Rhodes and Robbie Mook. Matt Rhodes, as you know, former campaign manager for Mitt Romney's presidential campaign. Robbie Mook served as campaign manager for Hillary Rodham Clinton's campaign. And Matt and Robbie just wanted to share some background and thoughts about the nature of this project and why they're so invested in it, and that we hope will be helpful for the commissioners this morning. So, Matt, do you want to kick it off?
First off, thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks a lot for letting us present today. I just wanted to start off and thank the Belfer Center at the Harvard Kennedy School, because that's where Robbie and I and Mark Elias and Michael Toner and some others came together and set up a group called Defending Digital Democracy. And that group is not affiliated with the C4 we're here to talk about today formally, but our time spent there and all the work that we did together there inspired the idea to try to set up a C4 focused on what we want to focus on in the cybersecurity space. I also want to thank Ash Carter, who's the chair of the Belfer Center, for giving us an opportunity, and Eric Rosenbach, and Debbie Plunkett, who is a part of our C4 but could not be here today. Wanted to thank all of them for the inspiration and bringing us together. Before I turn it over to Robbie, you know, one of the real big reasons why I think that this effort is so important, and Michael highlighted the fact that, you know, Robbie and I have worked on presidential campaigns. What we're here today and what we're trying to do isn't really to benefit presidential campaigns, which, as you can read in the newspaper, raise lots of hard dollars and have many, many, many opportunities to finance cybersecurity efforts if they choose to. But it's for the down ballot candidates, people that don't have as much hard dollars to spend. And when you're setting up a campaign organization, especially at the state level or even the federal level in a House race or a Senate race, when you're first setting up and you're first raising those precious hard dollars, the last thing you want to do is spend them on something to secure your networks or your candidate's email. And so why we came together, one of the big reasons for me is it's not that presidential campaign, but the little guy campaign that's setting up. And sometimes these foreign international threats or even our own domestic threats can see these rising campaigns, these rising stars, and really have an opportunity to disrupt our democracy at a level. You can see many of the rising stars coming well in advance. You know, people like former President Barack Obama, former President George W. Bush, you could see these rising candidates coming a mile away, and they're very vulnerable at that stage. And that's a big reason why I became a part of this. And obviously my own experience, which is in here, running the Romney campaign and the Chinese threat and hack that we had back in 2012. So that's how I was inspired to come into this. I'll let Robbie speak a little bit and talk about some of the other reasons why we think that this is so important. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Matt. And I want to echo our appreciation for you having us here today and considering this, and especially for being patient with us as we work this out. And I think it is really good that we are here now today doing this, given all the work that's gone in, because I think there's been our own rationale and thinking behind this has matured as we've gone through this process. So thank you for that. Just to follow up on what Matt was saying, you know, Matt and I came together because we both worked on presidential campaigns that had been affected by breaches, and that's, you know, how we got connected with the Belfer Center. And the project of the Belfer Center has actually done a lot of work with election officials, but when it came to campaigns, our hands were really tied because it's a nonprofit institution. It cannot be in-kinding assistance to campaigns. So I would like to believe we did everything that we could there. We produced a very detailed playbook for campaigns that explains, you know, every step they can take. We created a training video, and all of that is posted online, and therefore I'm not a campaign finance lawyer, but it doesn't have value. That was something that we could do to help. But what became immediately clear to us once those resources were put up was it wasn't enough. And to Matt's point, for the little guy campaigns out there, they still were not in a position to properly secure themselves. They just don't have the resources. And there are a few things in particular I wanted to point out where we think that this entity can make a demonstrable difference. The first is monitoring networks to see if bad people are in there. That's a really expensive thing. But if you ladder that up, it can be done at scale at a much lower cost and in-kinded to the campaigns. So that's one. Just, you know, if we're thinking about the issue of first, we're not interested in, nobody's interested in making money off this. We're all volunteers here today. And secondly, we're not looking for any loopholes. But there's just a fact that network monitoring is incredibly expensive, and if it's done campaign to campaign, it's not financially feasible. The second is incident response. So if something has gone wrong, and particularly if you have a nation state actor like North Korea in your network, you need very sophisticated people to go in and help you and figure out what's going on. Again, that is just not something that a small campaign is in a position to deal with. And the other very practical thing that we ran into is you have campaigns using email systems, and there are security settings that can be pre-toggled for them, but they're very hard to do on your own. And this is part of the problem. We created this playbook, and we're putting an enormous burden on campaigns that maybe have one or two staff. They're incredibly busy. The work's just not getting done, and so the threat remains. So I want to add to the list of to our list of gratitude here with Matt is to the Campaign Legal Center for submitting their remarks, because I think what they've done there that's really important is steep this in the context of preventing foreign meddling, and that really is our objective here. Not interested in, you know, some loophole for campaigns. We just want to make sure that these foreign nation state actors who are incredibly sophisticated don't have an open door to push on to get into the campaigns, and in particular that we're securing including the set of things I just mentioned that are fairly easy to do. They just take resources that the campaigns don't have. And the last thing I want to say is that, in case anybody's curious about this, you know, this is truly, based on Matt and I being here, a multinational issue. You know, the Chinese breached the 2008 presidential campaigns, the 2012 presidential campaigns. Obviously, we've seen Russia involved in 2016, not, by the way, just with people affiliated with the presidential campaign, but at the House campaign level as well. We've seen reports on the Republican Party at the House level as well. And this is multi-candidate. We've seen attempts to breach members of Congress. And I would just lastly say, there's probably a lot we just don't know. You know, and that's why, to me, getting things like network monitoring and incident response out there is so critical right now, because there may be things happening that we don't know about and are never going to get into the news. So with that, again, we just really appreciate you hearing us out on this today.
Thank you, gentlemen. I'll turn to my colleagues. Are there any questions or discussion? No questions or discussion? Whoa. Well, I have questions. Oh, okay. Go ahead. No. Go ahead, Commissioner Wolf.
First of all, I think that's a great idea, what you have in mind. It's really quite commendable, and I hope we can get this thing along the road in a way that you can get this done. Just out of curiosity, I see that there are some limits for being eligible, and it seemed to me that some of the people at the lower end might be cut out somehow because of the way they have, a certain vote amount or amount of money generated. But there are times when somebody is really struggling out there, and I'm thinking of my own home state, Nevada, not Vegas, but other places where people really don't have a way to even communicate in a way that would protect them. So do those limits, are they hard and fast, or what did you have in mind in a case like that?
Thank
you. Mr. Toner.
I'm sorry.
I'm recognizing you. No,
Commissioner, good morning. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
So a couple things. One is we tried to make the criteria as objective as possible, because obviously under your precedence, that's really an important factor. But a couple things also came to bear. One, we didn't want to limit this to just Democrats and Republicans. We thought this was really important. As you know, there's a lot of people in American politics, candidates and activists who are in neither party. And so we wanted to have criteria where third-party candidates, independent candidates, also could qualify for these services. So that's one thing that really stood out for us. Secondly, we wanted to create criteria where there were multiple ways to qualify. So we had the fundraising criteria, as you know, for U.S. House candidates who raise $50,000, Senate candidates who raise $100,000. But we also wanted to cover all general election candidates, no matter how much you might raise and spend. You know, we really thought that was important. And then of course, the national party committees and the presidential campaigns who poll at 5% or higher. But our goal was to try to make the criteria as self-executing as possible and not have really any discretion so that it would be objectively verifiable, but also be inclusive beyond just the two major parties, because we do view this as a nonpartisan endeavor at the end of the day.
Well, thank you all for coming. I think this is going to be very helpful, this discussion, and I really appreciate the work that you're doing on a bipartisan basis to address a very serious threat, one that I know I'm very concerned about. I know the entire commission is, and a lot of people are. And I commend you for the efforts. So what do you think the fair market value would be of the services that you're providing were someone to want to purchase that kind of protection? Anybody who feels like they know?
Sorry.
Mr. Mook?
It's hard. You mean if you purchase on the commercial market,
yep,
so to speak? Yeah, I mean, and I want to be really clear. I'm a campaign person, not a cybersecurity expert. So let's just, you know, let's put that out there. But when we were looking at this question, to have, you know, true network monitoring, so to speak, so putting sensors in, you know, you can be getting into the tens of thousands of dollars for a campaign. And then something like incident response can be very much in the tens and tens of thousands of dollars. Again, if you're dealing with a particularly sophisticated threat actor, when it comes to a two or three person operation, I can't say exactly for that. I had some visibility into what the DNC had to pay, and I'm sure Matt had visibility on the Romney campaign. But again, I think an important point to make here is if these campaigns have to go it alone, I think the cost is dramatically higher, if that makes sense. And they have, as I said, I am no cybersecurity expert. I've actually learned a lot over the last 2 years. If I was myself 10 years ago running a Senate race and I had to go out and find cybersecurity vendors to monitor my network, first of all, I wouldn't even know what that means. And second of all, I would have no criteria through which to evaluate that. And so I think one of the other benefits of this is hopefully that we are providing a trusted partner with which the campaigns can make good judgments about all of this.
Yeah. I would just add, first off, let me put it on the record, I am not a cybersecurity expert either.
Okay, let's put it on the record. We have no cybersecurity experts in the room. Okay.
That's not what we brought to the table. But when you think about what it would cost an individual campaign, even if it costs $1,500, if you're running for office in Elko, Nevada, and you're setting up a campaign, $1,500 in hard dollars, that's a lot of money. And what it does is it immediately kind of, if you're the campaign manager or the candidate, it's something, you know, you might want, but you can't really have if you're an upstart campaign. And that's why when we set up this campaign playbook, which I hope is helpful, everything that's in there for the most part is free. But at the end of the day, you get what you pay for. And so that's kind of how we came to the next concept, the next, you know, format of what we thought we could do and setting up a C4 to try to help that candidate in Elko, where $1,500 to have someone come in and look at a candidate's email systems and networks at home, they're just not going to do it.
But it seems to me that there's something in between. There's, you know, you're positing that every candidate would be on their own and they would therefore have to be buying at top value and would be, you know, perhaps not well positioned to find good services. I mean, another way of doing what you are trying to do would be to take advantage of scale, as you suggested before, you know, make a package of services available across the board. And because you're doing it for so many people and because you would be you would both be a trusted source, but because of the volume, presumably you could offer it at a reasonable but lower cost. I mean, there's no question that what you want to do is a good thing. The question for the commission is it legal? And the reason why that's a question is because you want to offer it for free as opposed to having people pay for it. So I want to make sure that in pursuit of a very good goal, that we do not inadvertently blow a hole through the corporate contribution ban. You know, that's where I'm coming from. So, you know, I would like to support this endeavor. I also have an obligation to protect the law. So one question that I have is, given the scale at which you would be able to do it, couldn't you just offer this at a reasonable price?
And Madam Chair, I completely appreciate that position, particularly like my career has in part been about getting corporate money out of politics. So I'm entirely, as the Democrat here, I'm entirely sympathetic to that. And I, the last
thing— Maybe another Democrat over there.
So. Yeah. Well, yeah. My sidekick here. Yeah. Keeps me out of trouble.
One day at a time.
So the last thing I would ever want to do is create a loophole like that, trust me. Particularly, you know, in this space right now. I guess what I would point to in particular is this is two things: monitoring these networks and providing incident response. If someone is breached, I mean, it's weeks, maybe even months of work to really get in there and figure out what's going on. That's enormously expensive. And I don't, based on our evaluation, I don't see a way to just kind of package that up. There's a secondary issue that we have, which is working with major email providers to create some sort of pre-toggled version of what they're doing. And what we have encountered in the corporate space is that for them to start doing that, are they triggering some sort of in-kind by providing a special service to campaigns? So again, I really appreciate the point you're making. And I think for us, it's the flexibility we're asking for here is less about just get as much, you know, it's like Walmart on the, you know, on Black Friday, where we're just loading everything in the cart and, you know, trying to run away with as much as we can. This is just about giving ourselves the flexibility that, you know, if you need really specialized network or sensors on a network, we can just get that done. We at least have the flexibility to get that done. That's really where I'm coming from. And I guess the other thing I'd offer as a way of thinking about this is, you know, this is really at the end of the, and I'm not a national security expert either, this is warfare in a way. I mean, people are trying to disrupt our democracy, and the people, the agents that are doing this are members of the military, basically, in other countries. And so, you know, if campaigns needed military weapon systems to defend themselves, we'd say, my gosh, they don't know anything about that. How are they supposed to be able to do that? So it's sort of an extreme example, but I just say we're really looking at a similar level of sophistication, and all we're asking for is that flexibility to deliver the capabilities they need when they need them. And part of the reason we have the C4 is to wash away that interaction that would create the influence that you and, frankly, I would be really concerned about.
And Madam Chair, if I might, just to build on Mr. Mook's comments, because this corporate contribution issue, obviously the heart of this, and we take that very seriously. And so we tried to design what we were proposing here with a number of layers of insulation to maintain the integrity of the corporate contribution ban. One, we've talked about earlier, the objective criteria, you know, the neutral objective criteria. Secondly, the fact that we really run this organization like a charitable organization. As you saw in our papers, even though this is organized as a C-4, we're following the strictures, the IRS strictures for a 501c3 organization. These safeguards designed to not have this be for the purpose of influencing an election. And as Robbie was indicating earlier, and Matt may have touched on it, we don't even know the campaigns who are going to be attacked. We don't know where they're going to be running. We don't know which party they're going to be running under, and it's not our focus. Who's going to most need these services? So we tried to build in those layers of protections, focused around trying to establish that this is not for the purpose of influencing a federal election, not designed to try to influence the outcome of what happens in the elections. And then the other thing that we've tried to do is make this as inclusive as possible, beyond just federal campaigns and committees. We think that's really important. We've begun work over a number of months with some non-governmental organizations, civic organizations. Our papers mention a couple that we've already started working with. We're looking to recruit more because I think our view is this has got to be an inclusive process involving government, involving civic organizations, involving campaigns and parties. That's absolutely true. But have it be as broad a universe as possible. And you know, the focal point there being, first of all, we think it's the right thing to do, but beyond that, that this is not just about elections. This is about protecting the democratic process at all levels. So it's a long way of saying we've been trying to do everything possible to insulate this process from the corporate contribution ban, because, Madam Chair, I mean, that is the central issue here. And that's one reason why over these months we've needed a little bit extra time on this to build out those safeguards. But that was the aim of our endeavor there.
So there's obviously a lot of money behind this operation. How is the money raised? And are there any candidates, office holders, politicians involved in the fundraising? Are they insulated from any contact with the funders? Because one potential problem I could see down the road, and I always have to worry about, okay, if we say yes to you, what's going to be the next question that's going to be asked, and what other entity out there might feel empowered by this AO to not even ask, perhaps, and just go out and say, well, I think based on that AO, I can do this. So one concern that I have is, could this become an opportunity for people who are trying to curry favor with office holders, perhaps office holders on both sides of the aisle, to give valuable prizes to them in order to have opportunities to, as I said, influence perhaps other policies?
You guys want to talk about the fundraising?
Yeah.
Mr. Mook.
So again, thank you. And again, it's a very good question. As it relates to fundraising right now, to be honest with you, Matt and I have been waiting to get a ruling on this until we really proceed with planning in depth. But I can tell you two things. Number one, we have no plans whatsoever to ask elected officials to engage in fundraising in any way. And secondly, the only donors that we have considered for the organization have been individuals and foundations. And lastly, I will add, our plan is to make the organization as lightweight as possible and to, again, get the resources to the candidates and parties as directly as possible. So we hope that the overhead of this organization is not enormous and that fundraising isn't an ongoing obligation in the way, for example, when we're on a campaign, that it is just a never-ending process and that you have to bring out surrogates and so on to keep that money coming. Our hope is to design a budget and a fundraising strategy that keeps fundraising to a minimum, frankly.
Can I add?
Sure, Mr. Ellis.
Can I add two unrelated points, related to your questions, but 2 points. The first is I want to be clear because it's something that I think was implicit in something that was said, but I want to make it explicit. Neither me nor my firm nor Michael nor his firm are being compensated to represent this organization. So when you say there's a lot of money in the organization and they say that they are lightweight, I cannot think of another instance where I have ever sat before the commission or submitted something before the commission as a pro bono matter, because as I explained to lots of very worthy organizations that come to me, I do pro bono in other areas, but one of the things I tell them when they ask me if I can represent them before the commission is that's the business that I'm in, and if I offer you free legal services, how am I going to tell the next good organization and worthy organization that, you know, I have to charge them? And the exception
that I remember that problem.
Yeah, and the exception that I have made in 25 years is for this organization. And it's because, frankly, they are looking to solve something that goes not to the threat of money in politics or the threat of loopholes in the system. They're going to something that, frankly, has the capability of undermining the ability to hold democratic elections at all. And in that sense, it is the most profoundly important work I think I've ever done before the commission. Because if ultimately, as Matt said, if ultimately nation states are able to pick and choose among the rising stars in the political system and essentially strangle them in the crib, then there will be then we simply won't have a functioning democracy. So I wanted to be clear that the statements that were made about this organization and its finances and the involvement, you know, extend to lawyers. And I hope, Michael, you didn't mind me revealing that with respect to your firm. The second point I wanted to make is a more broader policy, or a more broader policy point, which is at various times the commission has faced the application of a law that was passed in the 1970s to the realities of modern campaigns and technology and elections and threats and opportunities and the like. And one of the things that I think that you are always struggling with in that area is how do you remain, how do you keep fealty to the statute while at the same time allowing the statute to breathe and have that flexibility? And I've at various times urged the commission in other contexts to find that room to breathe. You know, I'm not a telecom lawyer. I know nothing about telecom. I know less about telecom than I do about cybersecurity. I know almost nothing about cybersecurity. But I'm always struck that there is this law that was written seemingly like in the 1930s or 40s or 50s, whenever it was, that is like applied to the internet. And like they have all these rulemakings about like things that they just couldn't have imagined existed. And yet they find ways to build flexibility or regulatory meaning around that. And I think that where this commission has been at its best, it does the same thing. And where it has come up short at times is where it's been unable to find a way to sort of bring these sort of concepts from, you know, the age of Buckley into the current age. And, you know, I think that it's notable that Campaign Legal Center, which is oftentimes, you know, I would say on the side of worrying about how that modernization would cut against loopholes, I think it's actually notable that they, what their second set of comments are. Because I think that the, you know, the last time I remember having this exact sort of discussion, it's been a while since I've been before the commission, but was, you know, both Congress in McCain-Feingold in Congress, then in a supplemental law, and then this commission in a series of advisory opinions, dealt with the question of convention funding, recount and litigation funding, and headquarters funding. And I think I sat here and said, if the commission can't find a way to make this work, the system just breaks. And when it breaks, like any number of things can happen. And I'm not sure that from the reform community standpoint, the resolution of that breaking point ended up in a more satisfactory position than they would have been than from their standpoint if the system had just breathed a little more. Because obviously the net result was Congress stepped in and passed a law which explicitly solved the problem, but solved the problem and then some. And that, I think...
Didn't you have something to do with that, Mr. Lyons?
I did. And the point is that there, the commission has an opportunity to do something, and I think CLC and others understand this. They have an opportunity to do something to let this statute breathe in a way that keeps, whether it's China or North Korea or Russia, from fundamentally undermining democracy. And I fear that if the commission can't find that space, what's going to come is either going to be something that's awful for democracy or something that may be less advantageous to people who are worried about those loopholes, like Robbie, like myself, like I know all the four of you do. I think that this is like a really good opportunity for this commission to show in a bipartisan time where you have literally, these are not your squishy Republicans. Like I know how to find those, right? If I listed my favorite Republicans, it wouldn't be. Anyway.
Oh, come on.
That's a compliment, right?
They're such nice guys. What are you talking about?
And I'm sure that if you asked them who their most favorite Democrats are, you wouldn't have Hillary Clinton's campaign manager and general counsel. So, this is an opportunity for this commission to sort of seize this moment and really do something that advances democracy. And I hope you do so.
I hear everything you're saying, but if it is one question that I have is if it is so important to democracy and if it is a national security issue, and I think it is on both counts, why isn't the government paying for this?
Well, so let me address that again. I think that there's a policy.
Or let me actually rephrase that a second. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but obviously it's not. You're not in charge of the government. I'm not in charge of the government.
Well, you're more in charge of the government than
right.
I am.
Well, I'm in charge of a little piece of the government, but not the one that would fund this operation. But I guess the question is really, would it be better if it were funded by the government rather than by private sources?
Look, I think there are consequences to all different kinds of public policy choices about how things are funded and not. We have a private funding system around elections. We went from having public funding of conventions, which I thought was relatively non-controversial, to now having private funding of conventions. So that's a policy judgment that, frankly, is above my pay grade or ability to wish one way or the other. I think, though, that in some ways the reason why I drew the parallel to the last, to the other. The last Cromnibus change is that in some ways you could say, well, that was a success. That was Congress exercising its legislative power. The other way to look at it is to say that there are these opportunities for the commission, like the FCC or the SEC or the others, to like say, we're going to take this old statute and we're a policymaking body in our own right. And we are going to take these statutes and we're going to put vitality in them to meet the challenges of today in the same way that the SEC does or that you are apparently around cryptocurrency, which is something that couldn't have been contemplated by the statute in the 1970s. And I think that this is like a really important moment for the commission to signal that when, two partisans come to you and say we want to help Green Party candidates and Libertarian candidates on the same basis as we help Democrats and Republicans. We want to help small candidates in Pahrump the same way that we want to do help them in Chicago. Like, I think that that's like an important moment for the commission, and that was, you know, and that it could also be an important moment for other branches of government, I don't think changes that.
So I'm going to ask one more question, then I'll turn it over to you, Commissioner Walther. So that kind of goes to it not being, you know, to bring it back to the law again, because it's a nice idea to breathe vitality into the law, but ultimately the law has to provide that breathing space. You know, there's just so far I can go given the words in the statute book. And what you said, it seems to me, goes to an argument that these services would not be for the purpose of influencing an election. But the more difficult question is, how is this not in connection with an election, which we also kind of have to get by? And I'll,
sure.
Either of the lawyers, Mr. Tony.
Absolutely. Well, I'll take a first stab at it.
Mr.
Lyons might have more remarks to offer. But a couple things. First, I think you're absolutely right. Those are two issues that are always on the table, and we've done everything we've tried as hard as we could to create the record that this is not for the purpose of influencing a federal election, that this is a nonpartisan endeavor, you know, in terms of how our organization's structured, the objective criteria, and how inclusive the process is. So that we really were aiming at for the purpose of influencing standard. In terms of the in connection with standard, a couple things I would offer. As you know, occasionally in the past, a number of times in the past, the commission's really wrapped up that analysis within the for the purpose of influencing a federal election analysis. For example, in the third millennium AO some years ago, as I recall, there wasn't an independent consideration or evaluation of the in connection with issue. It was really wrapped up in the larger for the purpose of influencing a federal election standards. So that's the first thing I would offer. And second of all, like we outlined in our comments, is that this is a broader endeavor than just working with federal campaigns and committees. We think that's really important. This involves civic organizations. It involves non-governmental organizations. It involves governmental organizations. And so to the extent that the commission focuses on the in connection with analysis, the fact that this is a really broad universe of organizations and entities that DDC is working with, we think that's important. We think that's significant, and also we think it's important for the organization to be effective. It's part of the programmatic mission of the organization. But Madam Chair, to go to your point, I mean we're very sensitive to these two issues. We've really done a lot of work over the last few months to try to safeguard our operations with those two legal issues in mind, that's how we approach them. Mr. Elias, you might have some additional thoughts.
All right. Before I turn to you, Mr. Elias, I just want to ask for a point of clarification. Mr. Toner, did you say you're also going to be offering these services to governmental organizations?
Well, we interact and work with them. We've had discussions with them, and we are working with them along with the civic organizations and the non-governmental organizations. I guess in our comments we mentioned the Truman Center for National Policy and the Hudson Institute as some non-governmental organizations we've been working with.
Yeah, I was just wondering, based on your comment, whether you meant to offer the same package of services to, and I'm just curious, to actual governmental organizations. I don't know, state, local governments.
You guys want to talk about sort of the government, the interaction with governmental organizations? And
well, Madam Chair, I was going to make one point because I thought you raised a pretty important point. Why not the government? And I'm kind of a realist, and I think we'd probably have a different viewpoint. But to get beyond why not the government, the reality
is— I like to think of myself as a realist. We might disagree on some other things.
Well, right now, the reality is the government isn't stepping in and helping campaigns. And the other reality that Robbie and I have seen on both sides of the aisle, I think you'd find a lot of skepticism amongst people that run campaigns right now, both on the left and the right, of whether or not they would want the government to step in and try to help make their networks more secure, the way Robbie's talked about.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that that's provided a need and an opportunity for us to come together. So I just wanted to go back to that point, and I don't know if Robin did.
Yeah, I just quickly add on that. I'll sort of answer both questions, I think. The first thing to underscore what Matt said is I think today, given a lot of different factors, it's not happening, A, and B, the campaigns, there would be barriers to entry potentially from the campaigns, and it is what it is if we're in a realist scenario here. I believe, however, that this organization, because it is bipartisan, because it is trusted by the campaigns, ideally, because it will be, you know, board members will be real partisans who are able to communicate with their respective communities, that we can actually begin to change that culturally, and we can be a catalyst to create a better, more productive, symbiotic relationship between the government agencies that, in theory, are supposed to be providing protection, and the campaigns. And look, Matt and I, to be frank, have a different point of view on the role the government should play. I have written about this publicly, so you can go read that. It is possible that as a result of this organization and as a result of that better relationship, it may be that the organization is no longer needed at some point. I would almost argue, I think Matt and I would agree on this, maybe for different reasons. I think it would be nice someday if this didn't have to exist at all. It's just not a problem. You know, there's, and, you know, physical security didn't used to be something the government provided, and it does today. So I think we have different viewpoints on where we'll get. I believe no matter where you think we need to go, I think this organization can help to speed that up. As it relates to government entities and election officials in particular, we've done a lot of work through the Belfer Center with election officials. It's been really productive. They've made clear that they want to create separation between them and campaigns, which I think is entirely understandable. So we've explicitly did not put the election infrastructure in here. It is just for campaigns.
Mark, do you want? Yeah, please.
Yeah, if I can address the in connection with.
Yep, please.
So I think that you could probably write a treatise on in connection with an election. If you look obviously at what the Federal Election Campaign Act was intended by Congress to be. You wind up with in connection with an election test that looks dramatically different than what, as the result of various Supreme Court decisions and other interpretations, the Act looks like today. I mean, in some sense, relying on in connection with an election proves too much because, the state of Virginia setting up polling locations is an expenditure in connection with an election. But yet the FEC doesn't tell the state of Virginia it can't do it. So if an incorporated city in New York, which most cities in New York are incorporated, most villages in New York are incorporated, puts out commandeers schools to hold elections in them, you don't say, well, that's a corporate expenditure because it's in connection with an election. Even though, as you know, states, unlike the federal government, states are not exempt from the contribution limits. You could have an incorporated town. So I think going down the rabbit hole of in connection with divorced from for the purpose of influencing, opens up, it just proves too much. I mean, the in connection with by itself would roll back huge chunks of the commission's existing regulations, all of, 109.21 or .20, whatever the, not 21, one of them's parties and one of them's non-parties, but, the whole purpose of cabining certain speech outside of, 90 days or outside of 120 days of an election was a recognition that there's stuff that's going to be in connection with an election in some sense. I mean, it has, but it's not for the purpose of influencing an election. So I worry about that as a doctrinally. I think that creates a little bit of problem. But beyond that, the purpose of and I say this as a good and loyal Democrat who grew up with Chevron deference and believe in it. The role of a federal agency is to give, is to put meat on those bones. And the, to, from my vantage point, the in connection with language and for the purpose of influencing language, the Supreme Court has set a ceiling as to what that can mean. In other words, it can't mean more than a certain thing. But this agency's got wide latitude underneath that ceiling, underneath that constitutional ceiling, to determine whether something is in connection with an election or not. Are recounts in connection with an election? As you recall, prior to the change in the law, the commission took a position with respect to funding recounts. Is redistricting in connection with an election? The commission has taken various, you know, is ballot access, getting on the ballot in connection with an election? Is defending a lawsuit against Fox News, against a former Senate candidate in connection with an election? In other words, the commission has a lot of territory, that a lot of ground that it can cover to decide that something is not for the purpose of influencing an election or not in connection with an election. You know, if a prospective Republican candidate travels to Washington, D.C. To meet with a mayoral group and also to meet with the NRCC, is that in connection with an election? The commission could say no. It's not in connection with election because the primary purpose of the trip was this other thing, and we're going to give primacy to that. So I think the in connection with language, rather than troubling me, it is what I keep describing as allowing this commission to give vitality and breathe life into this statute, because that's the kind of language that lets you look at something like this and say, you know what, we are here because we're experts, and we're just simply going to say that in this time, in this need, this is not for the purpose of influencing or in connection with an election. And so to me, rather than being troubling, I think that's actually, that's the enabling language allows you to grant what they've asked for.
But is that because that's what the words mean, or because we can just say that's what the words mean?
Because I think that the Supreme Court has told you what those words can't mean. It can't mean more than something. Underneath that is where you get to, as an administrative agency, you get to apply the experiences and the judgments that the commission has gathered. Madam Chair, you have been quite eloquent on the issues of foreign money and foreign involvement in elections. So this is something that I know is in your area of interest and expertise, as it is the entire commission. And you have sitting before you two campaign operatives, I hope that's not an insult, who have done that at the highest levels, at the mid levels, and at the smallest, the most grassroots levels, most grassroots levels. And they're here telling you how the experiences of real life should judge whether something is for the purpose of influencing or is in connection with. And they're telling you it's not. They're telling you it is not for the purpose of influencing an election. It is for the purpose of preventing foreign interference in strangling democracy. They are telling you it is not in connection with an election. They are telling you it's in connection with protection, in the same way physical security would be, in the same way that something else would be, and that's within your authority to do it. And like I said, the fact that the Campaign Legal Center does not typically endorse views that I have espoused.
I think that's fair.
Nor me.
Well yes. And
as Trevor reminds me regularly,
this is a rare moment for the commission to, you know, to bask in the consensus that you're hearing.
It's rare.
Thank you, Mr. Wise. Commissioner Walther, did you have another question?
It's hard to beat that. I think we all recognize that this is a very important thing, and trying to see how we can work with you and figure out something. But and I did want to ask you, and that was going to ask you before you spoke so highly of this Campaign Legal Center, you've seen their comments. How do you feel about them? The the points that they raise.
Thank you, Commissioner Walter. First of all, as Mr. Elias indicated, we welcome their comments and we welcome their support because they are very active before this agency, and they often don't concur with the things that Mr. Elias and I want to do. So we are basking in that momentary detente. We'll see how long it lasts. But a couple things. I mean, as we see it, there are independent grounds for the agency to approve the advisory opinion. I mean, we've been laying out one ground, which would be concluding that this is not for the purpose of influencing a federal election, not in connection with an election. And obviously, we've approached the advisory opinion under that framework. But then, you know, the Campaign Legal Center really is advancing an independent ground for approval, really focusing on law enforcement and protecting the integrity of the foreign national ban. In American elections, and we respect that. We respect the viewpoint that the Campaign Legal Center is articulating. So we see it as an independent ground. It's novel. I mean, I will confess, it's a novel ground, but we respect it. So I think that's how we see it. That there is independent ways for the agency to approve this matter if you decide that's how you want to come out.
We've done that a little bit with respect to that Sergeant-at-Arms one, where we provided a method to provide security, a little out of the normal bailiwick. This is one like that.
Yes.
In some regards.
Yes, I think that's right. I think that's right, Commissioner.
Well, I have to point out, in the Sergeant-at-Arms case, we said they could use campaign funds. We didn't say you're being physically threatened and therefore you can accept free services from security companies. So it's not necessarily a good precedent for what you're asking for today. Did you want to? Commissioner Hunter.
Do you guys have any more questions?
Go ahead, Bob.
Not at the moment. Go ahead.
Okay. This has been an interesting exchange. Thank you to all of you for coming. I just have, you know, listened to everything you said. I agree with everything all of the commenters have stated today. And I just see absolutely no evidence that anything you're doing is for the purpose of influencing an election. I just don't even see that argument. And so for me, it's an easy call. I respect where my colleagues are coming from. You know, we're willing to work with them. But as Mr. Elias states, there's been many times where we've said something that, in my mind, is closer to an election than this. And we've said it was fine. I think the recount AO is the example you're talking about, and there's a lot of other ones. This is so far attenuated from that, in my mind, particularly because it's a bipartisan effort. You have objective criteria for campaigns to get involved. It just, for me, is a very easy question. And a rare opportunity to do something to stop foreign influence in elections, which obviously all of us favor. I think that the notion that a government would get involved in this sort of work, I agree with what Mr. Rhodes said. There, I don't know of a single campaign, especially on the Republican side, that would turn their computers over to the government. And I know even state election officials who are dealing with voting machines are adamantly opposed to doing so, and many of them will fight to the end to avoid that. So the notion of that working is really far-fetched and doesn't really support the federalism, you know, that we all live with. So I think this is a terrific idea. I'm in support of draft A. To the extent that the CLC comment is something that the requesters have supported, I'm willing to support that with some edits, with some relatively minor edits that we've shared with our colleagues yesterday afternoon. We're willing to support that with some edits at the appropriate time.
Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and appreciate all of your presence here for the comments that you've delivered, both in written and also here. I think that you've made a very strong case for why an advisory opinion should be issued on this particular question. For many of the reasons that Commissioner Hunter just mentioned, I also support draft A. the fact that this is being offered on a nonpartisan basis, that there are objective criteria to establish who can participate, the fact that it has a broader mission than just candidates and parties, and is also extending to civic organizations, non-governmental organizations. For that reason, I believe that the analysis about this not being for the purpose of influencing an election or in connection with an election is correct and therefore would not be a contribution. And so I would support that. If we don't have four votes for that, and we there's a desire to look at the independent basis regarding the preventing violations of the foreign national prohibition at Section 3121, I'm certainly open to working with my colleagues on that. We've had some further discussions, and from the. Hopefully, I'm not overstating it, but from those discussions, I have some optimism that we could arrive at a yes. I just want to state what my position is and indicate my willingness to work with my colleagues. And it would be great if we could even wrap that up today when we have requesters here with us so that they could get an answer to their question.
Let me ask one other question. You're organized as a C4, not a C3?
Correct, Madam Chair, a C4. That's correct.
So do I have to worry about this turning into a lobbying organization, based on – I'm just kind of perplexed as to why it's not a C3.
Well, so, Madam Chair, I'll two things. As you know, in our organizational documents, we have required the organization to operate consistent with being a 501c3 entity in terms of no intervention in federal elections within the meaning of the C3 prohibition. I'm not aware of any lobbying efforts the organization's planning, but Matt and Robbie, any comments you want to offer on that? Or I'm not aware of any such plans or activities.
No plans.
Any comment on why you chose a C4 rather than a C3?
Did we think about it? Did we ever think about it?
My recollection was we couldn't do a C3.
Yeah.
Oh, I'll.
Yeah, just please.
I think that there are obviously greater restrictions on 501c3s. With respect to, because of the tax deductible contributions. The organization is going to operate as a C3, operate programmatically as a C3. The question of whether or not the IRS would believe that the organization met the definition of 501c3 was a complex enough question. They may very well have. They may not have. You are in a greater state of limbo in that circumstance than doing what we did here, which is essentially seek to just where we simply are a C4 that is operating as a C3. If that.
I hear you. I'm looking to see. Well, this is what I am going to suggest. I'm not comfortable with draft A. I think that each of us have looked at the comment that was submitted by CLC and thought that could be a basis for moving forward, but we each had our own thoughts as to language that we'd like to see tweaked in there. Obviously, we would have to have a final document on blue paper for us to vote on, and we don't have that at this moment. And we have a couple of other requesters who have been patiently waiting to have their AOs discussed. So what I'm going to suggest to my colleagues is that we move on to the other AOs and then take a recess and perhaps come back at, I'm guessing, 2, something like that, to give us time to go back through that third alternative and see if there's some place that four commissioners could land. Does that work for folks, Mr. Vice Chairman?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I think that's a, I think that that is a constructive suggestion. I think that the other requesters, I think, would appreciate that we dispose of their matters while we go through those negotiations. But I appreciate that we might be able to get this done today while we have requesters here, and that this matter, which is you know, for a variety of reasons, had to have been extended a number of months. That we might be able to not have that extend even another few weeks. So I think that that's a very good suggestion. Look forward to working with you further on seeing if we can't craft a consensus.
And hopefully would be able to provide it to the requesters with, you know, at least a little bit of time to read through it and see if they wanted to provide us with any comment on any ultimate draft where we thought we might land. Commissioner Hunter.
I just don't know if the requesters are going to be able to come back at 2 o'clock. I mean, they have other jobs, clients, and that sort of thing. And so in the event, I'm just asking you, would you rather come back at 2 o'clock, do this the next open meeting, or are there issues that we want to discuss regarding the what we can call the compromise draft that we want to ask them now while they're here so they don't have to come back at 2 o'clock? I mean, I think, as I said earlier, the edits that we made to the CLC draft were relatively minor. I'm happy to talk about that. If you have any questions with, for them now, do you guys want to come back or come back a different
can
day?
We caucus for
can we? Could we?
Yes, absolutely.
Just
absolutely.
2 minutes. Could we just?
Yes, feel free.
Thank you.
And
thank
I'll
you.
Just while you're doing that, I'll just say in response to my colleague's question, I'm not inclined to try and write the document at the table. I've never found that to be the best way to get a well-crafted document done. But we'll recess for a couple of minutes here. Okay, back from our little recess. Requesters have informed me that rather than wait around and see what happens at 2 o'clock, they'd prefer to just hold it over for the next meeting in 2 weeks, even though that will be take your kids to work day. And all the kids will be very entertained by that, I'm sure. So I just have a couple more questions for you. You've made a very compelling case, and requesters are plainly, you know, sincere and thoughtful, and you have very eloquent attorneys who are very persuasive. Let me just ask a couple more questions. One is, I hear what you're saying about how small first-time candidates, up-and-comers, you know, don't have a lot of resources. But the parties have a lot of resources, so why not have the national party committees provide this service for all of their candidates?
I think, you know, a challenge, I'm going to speak for the Democratic side, obviously. I can't speak for the Republican side. I think a challenge that parties tend to face, or at least we have tended to face, is the leadership. First of all, the party is fragmented into multiple committees, A. B, the leadership of those committees changes every few years. And C, you'll be shocked to hear, there's gambling in the casino, there's politics. And so...
I am shocked.
Yeah. So in the same way that I would love to say, we'll just go to the FBI and Department of Homeland Security and just have a conversation, explain all these vulnerabilities, and they'll come and they'll walk into the campaigns and fix everything. I would love to be able to say that the Democratic National Committee or the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee could sit in a room, work out a budget, deploy this out, and there's no problems. That's not, you know, we've had a lot of discussion today about what's realistic. Frankly, given the threat and the urgency, it's just not realistic. And I wish that was the case. And you know, Matt and I, again, I'll speak for the Democratic side, you know, we've been doing everything we can, and we got to this point because it just wasn't enough. And the breaking point for me was when a House campaign was breached this year in California on the Democratic side. It just – and it was utterly preventable. And so, again, I would be the first one here today to say if this thing doesn't need to exist in 5 years – that's terrific. We've done our job. We've gotten to a better place. But for the next few years, on the Democratic side, we need this.
I would just add the campaign committees on the Republican and Democrat side were very helpful in our efforts at the Belfer Center, especially in distributing the campaign playbook that we did. But back to being a realist, I just don't know that these campaign committees, A, would have the resources to do it.
Well, the National Party Committee seemed to have, you know, pretty healthy budgets.
We could debate that, but I still don't believe that they would have the resources to do this. And just like, and I think Robbie was kind of making this point, just like the point I made about the federal government being involved and looking at network drives, there would be Republicans running for office across this country that I don't think would be in tune with Republican Party officials at the national level going through their computers. And I think that would be the same on the Democrat side as well.
And but do you think they would be comfortable with your folks doing it?
I think that, yes, they would be more comfortable. Would everyone be comfortable? Of course not. Of course not. But I think more would.
Isn't the Kennedy School sort of, you know, associated with that nefarious liberal elite Eastern institution?
I want to thank the Belfer Center again. About the Harvard Kennedy School, they've been incredibly.
I would helpful. Also just point out, this is a factual matter.
Okay.
Obviously, the request covers independents and third party candidates as well.
No, right.
Okay.
Of course. That mm-hmm. Though I am not often associated with minor parties, it is important just as a factual matter that solving this for the two major national parties wouldn't necessarily solve it for independents or. Minor party candidate.
Can I make another quick thought on this? Is that the other thing we encountered is if parties themselves try to go to providers and begin talks, particularly on customized support, there's immediately an issue around favoring one party over another. And so I actually think this provides a way to create the custom tools and support that campaigns need that doesn't actually on the other end create the appearance of favoritism by an entity. So that would be just another thing I'd put out there. I think we'll actually move faster at getting what we need through this vehicle. And then look, and I would say this without favor to either party, I think this also means everyone in any party will have the same access to the same things right away. And therefore, I actually think we are creating a more even playing field, you know.
Level playing field. Are we allowed to do that? Sounds good to me. But Commissioner Walton, did you have a?
I just want to say I don't know if you're going to be able to be available next, you know, Thursday after next Thursday. But I really feel this is a great program, and it wouldn't work. It wouldn't work if it was, you know, the parties. It just like for the various reasons you mentioned, you wouldn't get the same receptivity from the people who are independents. Or other people that are, you know, actively involved. So this is a great, I think, format or a method in which to do it. I was going to ask you, how are the leaders going to be so, there's three people now who would be on the board, right? And then who will be choosing the next board? How is the composition of the people who are running the agency going to be selected? Excuse me, I used the word agency. I mean, entity.
You mean the, sir, the staff or the? I think that Matt and I have only talked about this very briefly, but I think we would seek to find staff that are credibly nonpartisan and actually, more importantly, credibly expert in the area. And unfortunately, Deborah Plunkett couldn't be here today, but she's the former director of information assurance, so basically cybersecurity at the NSA. And she's a really important part of this triad. You know, if we're representing the parties, she's representing the expertise. And I think that's where we'll really lean on her to provide assistance in identifying the right talent.
I didn't mean so much who the people were, but it's just, the, you know, the structure, the governance structure for the future.
I think
you have a board of five because you're going to get bigger.
So, Commissioner, we have a board of three. We have a board of three, and they can serve renewable terms. And so, Robbie and Matt are serving on that board along with Deborah Plunkett as well.
That's right. And then a vacancy gets selected by the remaining two or something like that.
That's right. That's right, Commissioner.
So I guess one last question for the lawyers. So So assuming that we find a place where four commissioners can land, what comfort can you give me as exactly the kind of smart lawyers who are always looking for a way to advantage your clients, that this will not become something that smart lawyers will use to try and broaden the opportunities for undermining the corporate contribution ban?
Do you want to start? Well, I think, Madam Chair, I think a couple things. First, clearly advisory opinions limited to, by their very nature, the particular factual circumstances of each matter, and we take that very seriously. And this is clearly a unique matter, a unique proposal before you. So I think that's the first point. Advisory opinions, by their very nature, are self-limiting in that way. Secondly, I do think the agency over the years, there has been some extra language that has been inserted into some advisory opinions to make that even more clear than it otherwise would be. That might be appropriate here. Obviously, we defer to the commissioners in terms of how they ultimately land in this matter. And I think finally, our focus is trying to attack this problem, and if we do get the agency's approval to get going, trying to provide the support in this area. But I do think by the very nature of an advisory opinion, it is self-limiting to particular facts of our organization and the activities that we're proposing to engage in. And I do think the commission has added extra language sometimes in these unique advisory opinions to make that clear. And if you chose to do that in this matter, obviously we would respect that.
Want to add anything, Mr. Elias?
I mean, I don't have anything brilliant to add to that. It may be that I am I'm less creative than.
Oh, that's not my experience with you, Mr. Elias.
It's hard for me to see this advisory opinion doesn't seem like it's opening much in that direction. Like I'm not sure I know where one would go with it if one was trying to build this into a broader loophole.
I just have sometimes been surprised in the past where these things
as
have
I
went.
Said,
Commissioner. That brings up a question. Is there something that you have in mind, Madam Chair, that you're concerned about, something in particular? Because I have the same sentiment and have on this AO. It's already cabined in and, significantly. I would want to be careful. Mr. Toner suggested other language reiterating that. I would agree to something, but not something that contradicts the statute, which says other people that are similarly situated can rely on this. So I won't do anything that violates that, and I'm not suggesting that Mr. Toner is suggesting to do so. But do you have something in particular that you're concerned about? I'm wondering all this time if there's a case in your mind or there's a situation that you're particularly concerned about?
No, just a long history of things that seem reasonable at the time, and then somebody else comes along and says, aha, now that they've said that, I can do this. And then, it gets to an enforcement context, and lo and behold, there aren't four votes to do anything about it. It's just nothing in particular, just years of experience.
And I think, Madam Chair, I think one reason we were comfortable holding, having an extension of time to the next open meeting is if commissioners support a draft with new language, we obviously would want to have time to carefully look at that and potentially provide comments, because we have to evaluate whether whatever the draft might indicate, whether it would be feasible for us to operate consistent with the draft. And so we wanted to have the ability to offer those comments if that would be helpful.
And we would want you to have that opportunity.
Michelle, that brings me to, I assume we all agree to put whatever draft, consensus draft we're able to come up with on the public record.
Absolutely.
As soon as possible, with the hopes of, if not today, then or tomorrow, early next week. I'm hoping we can commit to that.
As soon as possible.
Okay. And then that would provide the requesters an opportunity to comment, publicly.
Yeah.
And perhaps if they say we're great with it, We could approve it on a tally vote, and that would also mean that they wouldn't have to, some of you or all of you wouldn't have to come back to the next public meeting, obviously.
That's a possibility. I would want to make sure that we had it out on the public record long enough, not only for the requesters to comment, but anybody else who wanted to weigh in on it. Okay, well, hearing no other comments or questions, we will hold this over till the next meeting with the goal of trying to find a place that four commissioners can land. And I thank you all very much for all of your time and your thought and for your efforts to solve a very serious problem.
And can I thank all of you for your time and attention and thoughtful questions and comments, and also I've been in the situation of being the next requester in line, so I also want to thank the next requesters for their patience in allowing.
Now maybe we should have done you guys last.
Well, I didn't offer that. I offered thanks.
and Madam Chair, we really appreciate also having a chance for you to hear from Matt and Robbie. We thought that was really important, and we know that takes additional time, but we appreciate the consideration and the opportunity for our clients to be here today.
I appreciate it also. I appreciate your coming. It's been extremely helpful to have this discussion.
Thank you. Robbie and I just also want to thank Mark and Michael's teams. You know, we talked about how we're lightweight. We're actually not lightweight. We're no weight because they've put so much time and effort into this, and we wouldn't get the opportunity to be here to speak before you if they hadn't put the time in. So thank you.
And I noticed that in the spirit of bipartisanship, you've got Michael's associate sitting next to Mark and Mark's associate sitting next to Michael.
We lay it on.
Or are your partners? I'm sorry. I don't want to offend anybody. Thank you all. Thank you all very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, we appreciate the patience of the other requesters. The next item on the agenda is Draft Advisory Opinion 2019-04, Prittany LLC by Jeffrey Hardin Esquire. Are you Mr. Hardin?
Good morning.
Welcome. We will begin. You okay?
Yeah.
We will begin with a presentation by Mr. Paulson of the General Counsel's Office. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Weintraub. Good morning, Commissioners. Before you is Agenda Document 19-13-A, a draft advisory opinion to a request from Prittany LLC, which has developed an online contribution processing platform that enables users to make contributions to principal campaign committees and national political party committees. The requester asked several questions regarding the applicability of the Act and Commission regulations to its activity. The draft concludes that both the provision of contribution processing services by Prittany to individual users and enrolled political committees, as well as the provision of social networking services to enrolled political committees, do not result in contributions by Prittany to the recipient committees, because Prittany satisfies the criteria to qualify as a commercial vendor. Specifically, Prittany renders its services in the ordinary course of business and at the usual and normal charge for such services. It forwards contributions to political committees through segregated accounts, and it employs adequate screening procedures to ensure that it is not forwarding illegal contributions. The draft further concludes that because Prittany will be acting as a commercial fundraising firm, it is not subject to any of the reporting requirements under the Act. Finally, the draft concludes that Prittany's practices, as described in the request, comply with the applicable forwarding requirements. We did not receive any comments on the request or this draft. Thank you, and I would be happy to address any questions that you have.
Thank you, Mr. Paulson. Do we have any comments, questions? Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't have any real questions or comments, but since we have counsel here, I wanted to give you the opportunity if you have any questions or comments of the commission at this time. Or,
particularly since you've waited around this long.
Is there anything that, that you want to speak to with respect to this draft that the commission...
Well, thank you for the opportunity, and you know, thank you for your consideration of the request, you know, and for the tutorial this morning on some FEC legal matters. Found very interesting as a lawyer, so the time spent listening to that debate was was interesting to me. The one thing I did want to say is thank you to the staff of the Office of General Counsel. They're very helpful. I'm not an FEC lawyer, and so their guidance about the process, explanation of the issues or concerns they had, and the feedback that they gave about my client's business proposition was very well received. So I really appreciate the help.
Well, thank you. And I'm always glad to hear confirmation from the outside of what we see every day on the inside, that we have really excellent people working in the Office of General Counsel. Any further questions, or perhaps we have a motion, Mr. Vice Chairman?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. In consideration of Draft Advisory Opinion 2019-04, brought by Prittany LLC, I move approval of Agenda Document Number 19-13-A, which we've otherwise known as Draft A.
Vice Chairman has moved approval of Agenda Document 19-13-A, an answer to Prittany LLC. That will become Advisory Opinion 2019-04, should it be approved. Are there any questions or discussion on the motion? If not, I will call the question. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye. And the motion carries unanimously. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
You obviously were incredibly persuasive.
We tried hard to fall, four square within past precedent. With the guidance from the General Counsel staff, I think that was achieved.
We appreciate getting an easy one sometimes, so thank you, sir.
Thanks.
The next item on the agenda is Draft Advisory Opinion 2019-06, Lee Brown by Jessica Johnson and Jason Torchinski. Welcome, counsel. And we'll begin with a presentation by Ms. Waldstreicher of our counsel's office.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Weintraub. Good morning, commissioners. It's still morning.
It is.
Agenda documents 19-14-A and 19-14-B are alternative draft responses to an advisory opinion request submitted by Lee Brown. Brown is a candidate in the upcoming special election for North Carolina's 9th Congressional District, for which the electioneering communications period will begin on April 14th. Lee Brown and Associates is a for-profit real estate business incorporated in North Carolina. Brown has recorded radio ads for the business that identify her by name but make no reference to her candidacy. The request asks whether these existing ads may be exempted from the definition of electioneering communication, or if not, whether proposed alternate versions of the ads would be electioneering communications. Draft A concludes that the existing versions of the ads are not entitled to an exemption from the definition because they are not plainly and unquestionably not related to the election. Draft B concludes that the existing versions of the ads are entitled to an exemption because they do not promote, support, attack, or oppose any candidate, and they are plainly and unquestionably not related to the election. Both drafts conclude that the alternate versions of the ads would not be electioneering communications because they do not contain unambiguous references to a clearly identified federal candidate. We did not receive any comments on the request or on the draft, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Excuse me, Madam Chair, is your mic
on? Oh, it says it's green. Is it not on?
I hear you now.
Oh, okay. Brand new, fancy building, but sometimes the technology doesn't always work. I'm substantially in agreement with Draft A, although with respect to the alternative versions of the ads, I'm not really persuaded that changing it to Lee Brown and Associates when the ads are voiced by the same individual who has been voicing ads for her eponymous company for 13 years, that adding the word and associates really makes it substantially different from the analysis and changing the I to we, I guess, in the text of the ad. Makes it substantially different from the analysis under question one. So I think even the alternative versions are would fall under the electioneering communications provision. However, if somebody else voiced the ad with the same text as in the alternative version, I think that would move it a step further away from the candidate, and that would satisfy me. So that's where I am. I think it's different from the Darrow precedent, which I guess is the closest precedent, because there were actually two Russ Darrows, and the candidate was not, in fact, the guy that was running the company at that point or had been for a good decade. So I think it's close, but not quite analogous. So that's where I am. I don't know if anybody else wants to weigh in on this. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the drafts came in late and may have not given you an adequate opportunity to formulate a comment. Just wanted to give you an opportunity to comment on the late draft and just any other observations that you have regarding the competing drafts and their answers to your questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, or Mr. Vice Chairman. Obviously, our client would be happy with either draft. We prefer draft B, but if draft B didn't have enough votes, then we would support draft A. With respect to the chair's comments about the alternative version, I think the notion of the unidentified voice of a candidate was addressed squarely by the district court in Eastern District of Virginia in Hispanic Leadership Fund, VFEC, where the court concluded the unidentified voice of Barack Obama did not constitute an electioneering communication. Here, when the voice says, "We're Lee Brown and Associates, we're doing the following, we'd like to be your realtor," there's nobody that doesn't identify that voice as Lee Brown. And I think that the Eastern District of Virginia has already addressed that and ruled that the unidentified voice of a candidate, unless there is essentially overwhelming evidence that everybody knows that voice, is just not a clearly identified voice. In fact, at the Hispanic Leadership Fund v. Eastern District of VFEC argument, I actually was the lead counsel on that case, when Mr. Noddy, who was arguing for the commission, got up and said to the judge, "Your Honor, everybody knows the president's voice." The judge's response was, "I don't." And basically said, "Look, unless you can show me that everybody knows that person's voice, it's not a clearly identified candidate unless the radio voice identifies them." And so for that reason, I think the commission is compelled to conclude that the alternatives are not electioneering communications, at least in accordance with the judgment against the commission in Hispanic Leadership Fund. So I would urge you to reread that opinion before you rule, but I'd also ask you to rule very quickly because we may be in a position of needing to seek a TRO. The electioneering communications window opens on Sunday, and if our client doesn't know what ads they can run for their business, we may need to go to court very quickly. And if there's one way to discourage business owners from running for Congress, this is a way to do it. To say if you have a business that happens to share your name, a name that you chose before you even long before you decided you were going to run for Congress, and you need to stop advertising on broadcast when you or you have to totally change your advertising schemes when you run for Congress, that discourages people from running for Congress. And I don't think that's what Congress intended when they passed this statute.
Madam Chair, if I just...
Feel free, Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The facts as presented in this case where we know that the format that is proposed to be used going into the electioneering communications windows is the same format in terms of wording and in terms of structure as she's used for 13-plus years in terms of the kind of the catchphrases and identifying issues that are of importance in the real estate market, I guess, in the Charlotte area. And to me, that addressed the concern that if someone wanted to use their company and then all of a sudden changed radically the focus of the ads and that they were these hagiographic ads about the founder of the company and at the very end, oh, yeah, and get your real estate services provided by Lee Brown. I think that we might be in a bit of a different circumstance. That's a different question for a different day, but the evidence we have for us here is that we had a particular format with a particular individual and that we don't have any evidence that they are in any way being manipulated or changed in order to elevate her candidacy in any sort of maybe unspoken or unsubtle way. And for me, that was what was persuasive in wanting to put out draft B. That's the reason why I'm willing to support both the current proposal as well as the alternate versions. I had hoped that we would at least be able to land on the alternates, but I just wanted to express where my thinking is and why I'm prepared to support draft B.
Mr. Hunter.
I, too, am prepared to support draft B for the same reasons that the vice chair explained. And I agree with Mr. Torchinsky that if this is something that the commission's not able to agree, at least in part on, it will discourage people from running for political office. And I think that's a really valid concern. We have facts here, as have been explained. Somebody who ran a business for many years before they decided to run for a candidacy, and now they're not allowed to operate their business. It just seems completely, it doesn't make any sense to me whatsoever. And as is described in the draft, we do have the ability to state that somebody doesn't meet the electioneering communication requirement because of various factors. And these, to me, are squarely presented in both draft A and draft B, and I'm willing to support either of them if we can garner four votes.
Commissioner Walther.
I'll support draft A.
That's three.
I mean, one thing that maybe I could offer a little compromise, Madam Chair, that might satisfy you. I think there was some language in draft B that sort of discussed how the facts of this situation were unique and may not be broadly applicable. I wonder if there's a way to pull some of the language from draft B into draft A, where we talk about the fact that sort of in the alternative version that this is sort of a unique circumstance, right? It's not every business owner that has regularly voiced their own radio ads for a decade plus. And that's, I think, what makes this a little unique. And perhaps we can pull, in fact, that language is at...
And while Jason finds that, if I might, I think, you know, part of those unique facts are the fact that she has been doing this for 13 years. But these particular advertisements that we included, she wrote these advertisements and recorded them prior to becoming a candidate. So, they truly have had nothing, you know, to do with her candidacy since the inception in her brain. It's quite remarkable. She actually sits down and just speaks them and has for all of this time. But she went to great lengths to find a completely separate vendor, you know, in the political space to handle her campaign that has nothing to do with any sort of production or, frankly, anything to do with her real estate business at all. So I do think the facts are quite unique here in that I think that when the commission has considered this previously with respect to the Mark Wayne Mullen advertisements, I think there the commission felt like there had been some intertwining with respect to the issues and the vendors, whereas here she always ends her ads with a tagline that says, you know, I'm interviewing for a job, I want to be a realtor. There's a difference when you call Lee Brown. If we were to use instead, as Jason suggested, Lee Brown and Associates, which was approved or is suggested in the draft A alternative, I feel like that would perhaps provide some of those unique circumstances that the commission could approve.
Right. The language that I was thinking about in draft B appears on page 8 at line 3. Under the factual circumstances presented in the request, including that the ads do not promote or support Brown's candidacy or attack or oppose her opponents, and that Lee Brown and Associates has been distributing similar ads for the past 13 years, the commission concludes it should exercise its discretion. But I'm not saying that last sentence that begins on that continues on to line 6, but just the stressing of the unique facts, if you're going to adopt draft A but approve the alternative version of the ad, stressing that they're unique because they don't, you know, promote or support the candidacy, they don't attack opponents, and because of the long history of the same ads. And then again on page 9, in line 17, the commission's draft again stresses the unique facts here. And I think I'm wondering, Madam Chair, if bringing some of that language into draft A in proposing and in approving the alternative in these unique circumstances, particularly in light of the Hispanic Leadership Fund decision, whether that might satisfy any concerns you would have.
I hear what you're saying, Mr. Torchinsky. And I appreciate the fact that it does not appear that these ads were ginned up for her business in order to promote her candidacy. But the flip side of that is that the fact that she's been recording these ads for her own company that bears her own name for 13 years, to me, makes it a lot more likely that people actually will associate her name with her. The language in the draft on the non-alternative version that says Brown's statement in her own voice that I'm Lee Brown is an unambiguous reference to a clearly identified candidate, I have a hard time seeing the strong distinction in saying Brown's statement in her own voice that we're Lee Brown and Associates is legally all that different from the first one.
I understand you had I think you came out the opposite of where the court came out in Hispanic Leadership Fund.
Familiar but
I think
the Hispanic Leadership Fund decision, Mr. Torchinsky. I remember it well.
Right, but I think the court already – I mean, I hear your concern, but I think the court disagreed with you and said unless you have proof, all you have is a suspicion that because this voice has been associated with this real estate company that everybody knows that that's Lee Brown, the candidate for Congress, I think is a leap that you can't make. If a federal judge in Alexandria, Virginia couldn't identify the voice of President Obama, then why would the average listener in North Carolina be able to identify a particular voice and say, oh, that's the voice of the realtor who also happens to be a candidate for Congress? I mean, that's even more of a leap than everybody in Alexandria, Virginia knows the president's voice. And I think you're taking a leap that you don't have a factual basis to take when you say that.
Thanks for your opinion, Mr. Torchinsky. As I said, if somebody else – I don't know what that noise is. Oh, it's the construction across the way or somebody washing our windows.
The window cleaning.
Window washers. Sorry about that. Always a little disconcerting when you see – look out the window on a high floor and see a person out there. As I said, if it were somebody else's voice, I think that would solve the problem for me. But that's – it's where I am.
Sorry, I missed that because I was talking with Peterson. What was the last thing you said? Something would solve the problem for you?
Yeah, if it were somebody else's voice. I mean, it's Lee Brown and Associates, so presumably there's somebody else who works for this company. If somebody else were recording the ad and said, we're Lee Brown and Associates, then that would...
But why wouldn't that be an electioneering and communication under your theory just because somebody else is saying it? It still has the candidate's name in it.
The question is whether the voice in the context of the ad constitutes a reference to a clearly identified candidate.
And it only does if it's the person talking?
In this context, where this individual has been voicing ads for her company that has her name for 13 years, yeah, I think so.
But if Peterson said it, it wouldn't reference a clearly identified candidate.
I think that would provide if Commissioner Peterson wanted to do ads for the company. That would be odd, but if presumably it would be somebody else who works for the company who would say we're Lee Brown and Associates, then yeah, then I would view that as a reference to the company and not the candidate. I get it. You don't agree with me, but that's just
I'm just trying to understand the difference. What's the difference?
In a footnote that says what the facts are here, but a different person. I don't know. Maybe we can't make headway on that issue. It doesn't sound like it is. But I agree. How can we expect everybody to know who that is, even if the name it could be a different name, and same same name, different person. It could be the father, the son. It could be, you know. So, I think that's kind of unrealistic.
When Jimmy John's ran ads and had a Bill Clinton impersonator acting like it was Bill Clinton's voice, I mean, where's the factual distinction? I mean, would the average viewer know that that was an impersonator and not Bill Clinton's voice? I mean, when you start to get to you're making First Amendment based decisions based on what someone's voice sounds like, and assuming that people know who's speaking. I mean, you're really drawing a line that I don't think that Congress intended here.
I mean, if her daughter read the script and her daughter's voice happens to sound a lot like hers, is that problematic? I mean, how different does the voice have to sound from the voice of the candidate in order for an alternative voice to read the same ad and it be okay? And I don't think that just saying, oh, well, somebody else who works for the business, what if their voices sound really similar? Is that also problematic? And who's determining whose voice sounds similar? I mean, I think you start to ask a lot of a candidate to decide, oh, well, I'm going to choose, you know, Jane because her voice doesn't sound like mine. But if I choose Donna, her voice sounds too much like mine. You know, I think you're really drawing a fine line that isn't authorized by the statute or by the First Amendment there.
Well, actually, Mr. Torchinsky, you're the one who's coming up with the examples. I have a nice bright line rule for you. Have somebody else do the ad. I'm not asking what the other person's voice sounds like or whether they might kind of sound like the candidate's voice. Mr. Vice Chairman? Commissioner Hunter?
Would that be useful to you to have an AO that says if somebody else reads it? I mean, I'd rather not have to vote for that because I don't agree with it, but...
Could we have just a minute to consult? Absolutely. We might need to actually call the client and ask. So could we take maybe a 10-minute recess?
Sure.
Thank you.
10-minute recess. Okay. We're back. Mr. Torchinsky, have you had a chance to confer with your client?
Our client is unfortunately at a funeral at the moment, and we can't reach her. So given that, we would ask that the commission vote on draft A so that we can decide whether we're proceeding to court this afternoon.
Mr. Vice Chairman?
I'm going to make my motion on draft B to begin, and then perhaps we'll have another motion to see if it gets us closer to consensus. In consideration of draft advisory opinion 2019-06, submitted by Lee Brown, I move approval of agenda document number 19-14-B, the document we've been referring to as draft B.
Thank you. The Vice Chairman has moved approval of draft B of advisory opinion 2019-06, submitted by Lee Brown, as set forth in agenda document number 19-14-B. Any discussion on the question? If not, I will call the question. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
No. Motion fails 2-2 with the Vice Chairman and Commissioner Hunter voting in favor and Commissioner Walther and me voting against. Mr. Vice Chairman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the interest of trying to see if there's a little more consensus, I would like to make a motion on with respect to draft A on questions 2 and 3, which address the alternatives proposed by the requester.
Okay, so I understand the motion to be move approval of the answers to questions 2 and 3 in draft A.
Which is agenda document number 19-14-A.
Is there any discussion on that motion? I'll just say for myself that I view these facts as distinct from the Hispanic Leadership Fund precedent, which involved 8 words by the president in the president's voice and no mention of his name whatsoever, which I believe is fairly distinct from an entire paragraph in the voice of the candidate who identifies herself with the name of the agency, which is her name. So that's why I will not be able to support the motion. defer. Ready? Okay, we're back.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Mr. Vice Chair.
If I may. I made a motion before we went into recess. I was consulting with Commissioner Walther, and what I am going to do is I'm going to withdraw the motion that I made so that he can make a motion first, and then after that, then I'll subsequently reintroduce the motion that I made before we had the recess.
Commissioner Walther?
Are you withdrawn already?
Yes, yes, he has withdrawn his motion and turned it over.
We approve draft AO 2019-06, Brown Draft A.
Okay, Commissioner Walther has moved approval of Draft A of Advisory Opinion 2019-06, as set forth in Agenda Document 19-14-A. Is there any discussion on the motion? I'll just say that I am not going to support the motion. I would support an alternative that concluded that the proposed alternate ads would not be electioneering communications if voiced by someone other than the candidate. But that is not the motion on the table. So I will call the question. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
No. Motion fails by a vote of 1-3, with Commissioner Walther voting in favor and the Vice Chairman, Commissioner Hunter, and me voting against. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll once again make a motion to approve the answers in Draft A to the answers to questions 2 and 3 as set forth in Agenda Document number 19-14-B, known as Draft B, and we are in consideration of Draft Advisory Opinion 2019-06.
Draft B.
I meant to say Draft A. I apologize.
Okay.
Yes, Draft A.
I thought that's what you meant. Okay.
To be clear, yeah. Agenda Document number 19-14, Draft A.
So. Okay. The Vice Chairman has moved approval of the answers to questions 2 and 3 as set forth in Draft A, Agenda Document number 19-14-A. Any discussion on the motion? I'll call the question. All those in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed? No. Motion fails by a vote of 3-1. With Commissioner Walther, the Vice Chairman, and Commissioner Hunter voting in favor and me voting against. Anybody want to make any other motions? I've indicated my views. I'm not going to ask someone else to make a motion on my behalf, but I think my my views are clear if they are helpful to the requester. I'm sorry we were unable to provide the guidance that she seeks.
I just have one request. Is there any way we could get our closeout letter this afternoon so that we can go to court before the election and communications window starts this weekend?
Can we do that, counsel?
Yeah, we can. Certainly, we can do so.
We will certainly accommodate that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Staff Director, do we have any management or administrative matters?
Madam Chair, we have no such matters.
Okay, in that case, the open meeting is adjourned.